Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling to order the House Health, Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, welcome. As always, we would like members to mute your feeds and raise your hand if you would like to ask a question or make a comment. We are going to start by calling the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would call the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel. Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Kwan.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Keel. All right.
All right, a quorum is present. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. The first order of business would be to approve the minutes of January 26th. That was item two of the items that were sent to you. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes of January 26th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pryor is with a Y.
Thank you. Thank you. I know that.
Sorry, I've gotten it right before. So
I know. But now you'll remember the name at least.
So we're gonna start misspelling names just to make sure you're all reading the minutes. How about that? That's good. Very good, Eagle Eyes, Representative Pryor. So we'll get that corrected. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 You opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay, this is a kind of a, we've reached one of those milestones in our session where we hear the governor's budget. So those of you who are new, this is something that happens at the beginning of the new session when the governor releases his or, God willing, someday her budget. And so what we're going to hear today is an overview of those sections of the budget that impact this committee. And just so you understand the process here, the governor is required to release the budget at this time of year. And then we have the February economic forecast come out, budget forecast come out later. And based on that forecast, all of the numbers will have to be adjusted. So what we're going to do today is hear this, not really focusing on the exact numbers, because at this point, it's all preliminary. And we know that this year in particular, the budget was particularly difficult to project. There's a lot of uncertainty in our budget. And of course, that's because of the pandemic and how there all these changes are happening in our economy and in the national economy. So we're not going to focus so much on that, but we're going to just see what the governor is proposing for the budget in the areas that are before this committee. So with that, I'm going to, and by the way, these were sent out, the documents from this overview were sent out to you, and they would be documents 3 and 10. And and you know, also, I just want to note for members that some of what we hear today might have a little bit of crossover into the Human Services Committee. And so, you know, we'll flag those as we go through. But anyway, there's a lot of crossover, obviously, between health and human services. And so hopefully this will give members a good grounding, even if you're not in both committees. So with that, I'm going to ask Commissioner Harpstead to invite her to give her presentation. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. And I'm pleased today to be able to report to you on the health-related elements of the DHS portion of the governor's COVID-19 recovery budget. Our mission at the department is working with many others. We help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. This is what we called our Minnesota baseline as we started developing this budget. Minnesota ranks first nationally in delivering services for older adults and people with disabilities, according to three organizations in 2020. Third nationally in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes, according to the Commonwealth Fund in 2019. And seventh nationally for overall health, according to America's Health Rankings in 2019 as well. And we have all heard that Minnesota ranks almost last in the nation in racial equity. The Walz-Flanagan administration pledges for Minnesota to be the number one place for children to grow. And looking at Compass data recently, I noted that Minnesotans age 30 plus are 15% Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and Minnesotans less than 30 are 30% Black, Indigenous, and people of color. This shows you the total percent spending in total forecasted programs in the department. And if you look at the top bar, long-term, this is in our long-term care and home and community-based services in our MA health program. If you look at the top bar, you see how long that is. If you add the third bar to it, you get the total of our elderly and disabled services in Minnesota, and you can see how much of our total budget that represents. Laid out another way, you can see over the last 8 years, the growth and the totals in and various components of our budget. And so our highest budget item and the fastest growing over the last 8 years is in our long-term care facilities for older adults. The second line shows that the second largest spend is in our home and community-based waivers for people with disabilities and some of the older adults. Our third largest and our second fastest growing is services for the elderly and disabled. And finally, the very bottom line is what we spend on families. We've been looking at disaggregated data throughout COVID, which has been extremely instructive. If you look at the top bar, you'll see the population of Minnesota as it breaks out according to race. And then you can see that those long-term care facilities we just discussed, skilled nursing, assisted living, and group homes for people with disabilities are predominantly serving people who are white. The day services for people with disabilities reflect much more closely the population of the state of Minnesota. And it isn't until you get to the personal care attendant services for people with disabilities that you begin to see a disproportional share of people of color. This shows you the other end of the spectrum. The top bar is still Minnesota's total population, and you can see how our Minnesota public health programs split out on the next line, how our SNAP food support programs break out, and finally at the bottom, MFIB. And here you can see that Hispanic or Latinx Minnesotans are twice their proportional share of the Minnesota population enrolled in MFIB. Black Minnesotans have five times their proportional share of the population enrolled in MFIP, and American Indians nine times their proportional share of the population are enrolled in our MFIP program. I've said this many times before to this committee, my greatest learning in my first year as commissioner is that if I don't reach out proactively to the BIPOC, LGBTQIA+, and rural communities. The people I hear from are the larger, more well-resourced organizations who can afford the lobbyists, professional associations, and public relations campaigns. In other words, resources beget more resources. We have the responsibility at the department to make our $17 billion in resources available to support all Minnesotans. And so the budget proposal principles we went into the budget exercise with are first, housing first for all. It's hard for anyone to help their family move forward and succeed on their own without housing. Our second priority is whole family support and family preservation, not to mention childcare support, all needed to stand up our economy again and to help families thrive. We're eager to see people with disabilities living, learning, working, and enjoying life in integrated settings in their own communities, and a simplified and equitable access to home and community-based services for older adults and people with disabilities. We've known for some years now that baby boomers are not wanting to live in these long-term congregate care settings, and they are especially not eager to live there after what they've read during COVID. And now that Amazon, Lyft, and other services are available, we are eager to build out stronger home services for older adults and people with disabilities. And then we always have to pay attention in our budget to things like federal compliance and process control. We want to share with you today what's happened with the strategies that were forwarded by the Blue Ribbon Commission on Health and Human Services. The commission did achieve its goal of identifying $100 million in cost-saving proposals. We were all disappointed on the commission that we couldn't tackle the health transformation strategies due to the interruption of the commission's work by COVID, and we didn't fully examine health equity and administrative proposals. What was forwarded from the Blue Ribbon Commission into the governor's budget are three strategies for using state purchasing power to reduce costs, two strategies for more effective utilization of disability services, one strategy for allowing effective managed care across providers, and a strategy for further reducing fraud in state-funded services for a total of $61.4 million of the $100 million originally identified. We've decided, along with the governor's office, that other thoughtful policy improvements would be best left until after the market recovers and are not included in the governor's budget, leaving $38.6 million to come out of the budget reserve. So as we looked at our budget and first our savings proposals, we were working to protect children and family services from cuts that would cause even greater disparity, looking for savings proposals for little used or no longer needed funding, savings proposals that impact provider sectors least hard hit by COVID to the extent that we could. As I mentioned, deferring other thoughtful policy strategies, long-term care till the market recovers, and difficult choices in order to hit our target. In terms of our spending proposals, our first priority is meeting our responsibility to appropriately fund core services while maintaining safe, secure treatment facilities for 12,000 Minnesotans in our direct care and treatment, to invest in areas that stand back up a more equitable economy. You'll see higher wages for PCAs, investment in pathways out of homelessness, investment in family preservation and equitable access to childcare, improved MFIT functionality and a one-time increase to support employment, addressing healthcare disparities in birth outcomes and telemedicine. And we were also eager to honor our tribal consultations and county collaboration. We've had unprecedented budget conversations with our counties and our tribes, allowing us to begin to really think like a seamless, state-funded, county and tribal-administered human services system. The end result of our budget proposals ends with expenditure proposals of $184.2 million and reduction proposals of $137 million. The Blue Ribbon Commission proposals of $61.3 already accounted for in the 22-23 budget, leaving the non-Blue Ribbon Commission proposals just at $75.7 million. Our general fund impact then is a net investment of $108.5 million. We are adding $2.8 million to the Healthcare Access Fund and investing the TANF Fund to the tune of $71.4 million. I've been told by many people since I became commissioner that in a budget deficit session, everyone comes after human services. My experience of living in Minnesota for over 40 years is that in an economic downturn, Minnesotans rally around their neighbors and support human services. Now, Minnesotans have been through both a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic and an economic downturn, and I hope that all Minnesotans will choose to offer support to our neighbors who most need it coming out of COVID. Also, I presented to this committee a couple of weeks ago all we've done at DHS, or some of the things we've done at DHS over the past year to strengthen our process controls after headlines in 2019, and taking a big whack at our administrative budget would put that progress at risk. I'd now like to turn this over to our Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare, Mr. Matt Anderson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Commissioner Harpstead said, my name is Matt Anderson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and State Medicaid Director, and I have the opportunity, I'm pleased to have the opportunity today to go through some of our healthcare administration-related proposals in the governor's budget. The first is a reflection of the governor and lieutenant governor commitment to improving maternal and infant health, especially within communities of color and Native Americans. Minnesota has some of the nation's worst disparities in birth outcomes for African American and American Indian mothers and infants. Just within our medical assistance program, when compared with white mothers, Native American mothers experience 44% more premature births, 167% more extremely preterm births, and 50% more low birth weight newborns compared to white mothers. And African American mothers experience 33% more premature births, almost three times as many extremely preterm births, and fully twice as many low birth weight newborns compared to white mothers. This is reflected in mortality rates for African American and American Indian infants that are driven largely by these differences in extreme prematurity. Two to three times the rate of mortality for white infants. One of the ways that we are addressing that is through an innovative program called the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women, or ICHRP. This is a program currently for African-American women in the Twin Cities, and the proposal is to expand this program for more African-American women in the Twin Cities, as well as building similar regional care collaboratives for American Indian women in Duluth, Bemidji, and the Twin Cities. These regions were selected because they have the highest concentrations of African-American and American Indian births within our medical assistance programs. The ICHRP program, or Integrated Care for Health Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women, screens women at risk of adverse birth outcomes due to homelessness, hunger, untreated mental illness, substance use disorder, and institutional racism, and has culturally appropriate care and outreach to try to help reduce these stressors through culturally specific services and resources, including housing referrals, behavioral health care, and food resources or food security. The model relies on community leadership to establish and maintain local collaborative systems that have credibility with the women that we're serving and the ability to have effective outcomes. The program offers a significant potential for long-term savings in our medical assistance program because by reducing the number of children born preterm or with very low birth weights, we decrease the number of neonatal intensive care admissions, subsequent medical visits for children, adaptive equipment, even special education, and the likelihood that they may require medical assistance as an adult. The proposal that Governor Walz has put forward includes a net general fund impact of $1.6 million of additional spending in the 2022-2023 biennium and $706,000 of additional spending in the 2024-2025 biennium. Another proposal that many of you are familiar with is regarding telemedicine expansion. Early in the days of the COVID pandemic, DHS acted to expand our telemedicine statutes and rules to be able to expand access to care for our enrollees at times when there was either no in-person access or going to the clinic or getting care in person posed dangers due to the virus. Those temporary changes were widely applauded by providers and enrollees, and the legislature in the special session acted to continue these expansions through June of 2021. Governor Walz is proposing that we make some of these changes permanent, even beyond June of 2021. Some of the changes that are recommended is removing the current limit of 3 visits per week by telemedicine, removing that cap, expanding the types of providers who are allowed to provide services via telemedicine. And although our statutes, we believe, have always allowed for enrollees to get telemedicine services from their home, we want a statutory clarification to make sure that a person's home can serve as the originating site for telemedicine to make it more accessible and convenient for our enrollees. We also want for our providers, such as federally qualified health centers, certified community behavioral health clinics, rural health centers, Indian health services, and certain tribal clinics that are, in order for them to be paid, have to have a face-to-face encounter to be able to generate that payment. We want to be able to clarify and continue our existing services in telemedicine to allow for a telemedicine visit that includes real-time two-way audio and video to qualify for that face-to-face visit so that these providers can also get paid and their enrollees can also benefit from telemedicine services. Want to take a moment just to clarify that throughout the pandemic and in these proposals, we aren't making any suggestions or proposals to change the actual payment rates for services. These are merely just expanding access to care. The next proposal is to increase access to transportation for our enrollees. Medical assistants and Minnesota Care programs have long strived to eliminate transportation as a barrier for our enrollees to get care. We provide 7 different modes of transportation within our non-emergency medical transportation benefit. Currently, in order to receive a monthly pass on public transportation, which is one of those transportation modalities, a person has to use enough rides on public transportation for the cost of each individual ride to add up to the point where a monthly pass would be as or less expensive than paying on an individual ride basis. Governor Walz is proposing to expand the availability of public transportation for those enrollees who live in areas well served by public transportation by saying that if they are enrolled and they use public transportation for at least 1 trip for medically necessary services per month, that they can automatically be eligible for a monthly public transportation pass. By doing this, we are not only making healthcare, including medical visits, clinic visits, going to the pharmacy, we're not only making our covered services more accessible to our enrollees, we're also making it easier for them to get to work, to get to childcare or education and training services, to be able to get food or other transportation needs, all of which we know improve their overall quality of life and as a result, their health as well. We're proposing to redesign some of the outreach that is currently used for child and teen checkups. Child and teen checkups identify and address early issues that impact a child's overall health and development. They are scheduled on a developmental basis, and a critical component of that program is getting outreach to families to notify them that their child is coming due for their next well child check or teen visit. We are proposing that, and I should say currently, Minnesota's participation rate in child and teen checkup visits is below the national standard. So this is an area where, as we look at the health and wellness of our children and teens, this is an area for Minnesota to improve and to be able to help catch some of those issues and preventive care opportunities earlier in our children's lives. So this proposal would take and add responsibility to our integrated healthcare partnerships. These are provider groups that have contracted with the state to meet certain quality and cost thresholds for the medical assistants in Minnesota Care enrollees that they serve. These are providers in the communities focused especially on primary care. And so what we're proposing to do is contract with them to do the outreach to the children and families that they serve as part of their population. This would create a stronger connection between the primary care provider and the children and families that that provider is serving. In return, we would be making a small increase to the integrated healthcare partnerships payments from Medicaid and Minnesota Care. And in return to offset that increased spending, we would be reducing the contract amounts that we are currently paying to counties who are providing those services. The integrated healthcare partnerships serve about 50% of the children and teens enrolled in our programs, and only those children who are currently part of an integrated healthcare partnership will have this transition. The others will remain with county support. Our next proposal is two pieces related to pharmacy benefits. The state law is currently written, it limits the quantity of prescription drugs that an enrollee can get to a 34-day supply. Early in COVID, we recognized that this jeopardized access to medications for enrollees, requiring them to make more frequent trips to the pharmacy than other residents, and increasing that potential for exposure to the virus. So we implemented temporary changes to allow for 90-day prescription refills for non-controlled substances. This proposal builds on the learnings that we've had during COVID, and what it would allow is for refills, prescription refills, to have a 90-day supply, again, for non-controlled substances and for low-cost maintenance medications for people who have chronic diseases or chronic conditions that are going to require that medication over a long period of time. This reduces waste of having a prescription that really only needs to be for 30 days and end up having prescriptions filled for the full 90-day period. So we would eliminate and mitigate any of those risks of unnecessary costs while still making our services more convenient for our enrollees and increasing the likelihood that enrollees with chronic conditions are maintaining their best health by keeping their prescriptions. In addition, the proposal would reduce the dispensing fee paid for outpatient prescriptions. Several years ago, the federal government changed Medicaid rules to require dispensing fees to be based on a cost study. At that time, Minnesota had not done a cost study, so we used Indiana's as a relative peer and set our prescription dispensing fee at $10.48. We have to do a cost study every 3 years, so this is the first cost study that we've done, and based on the results of that study, we're recommending that the dispensing fee to more accurately reflect the costs of our pharmacies in delivering medications to our enrollees be reduced to $9.91. We have a few changes, as Commissioner Harpstead mentioned, that we are focused on compliance and making sure that we are operating our programs in accordance with the rules that the federal government has put in place. Several of those changes are highlighted here. The first is Medicare savings programs are a federal and state funded programs that help people who are enrolled in Medicare but are low income or low assets to be able to help them pay for their Medicare related expenses such as premiums, co-pays or co-insurance, those kinds of things. It's a existing program, but now federal law requires that a state cannot have an asset limit that is lower than the maximum asset level set by the federal government, called a low income subsidy or LIS. Currently, we're below that rate. There's no problems with our current program, but our analysis shows that the rate of our increase in asset limits will soon exceed the maximum amount allowed by the federal government in the years ahead. And so this proposal, before we get to that point, before there's any cost to the system or any disruption to our enrollees and their services, we'd like to clarify with our statutes to say that our asset limit will always be at or below the maximum amount allowed by Medicare. The third proposal here is changes in federal rules around health information technology systems and information sharing that those systems have to be able to perform in order to be compliant with federal rules. These rules apply to Medicaid as well as to other payer organizations in healthcare. And really, these are really geared toward making information more accessible to enrollees so that they can see their own claims information, get access to some of their health record information, be able to be more engaged in their own healthcare. And so they're very good goals that that the federal government has set out, but they do require significant IT changes for the state as we're using our legacy systems and having to get those into a form where they could actually be doing real-time data exchange with enrollees and being able to make sure that we're doing that with the privacy security protocols that we need to have in place. And so this would allow us to be able to meet those compliance requirements. There are two other technical changes that we want to be able to highlight for you. One is that hospitals report cost reports every year. DHS collects those cost reports. We use that data for a lot of our different payment systems, whether it's disproportionate share hospital payments or our overall budget pool for inpatient hospital services. Right now, hospitals have a deadline. They have to provide the data and provide any corrections or appeals within 12 months. Because of the claims lag in being able to adjudicate claims, hospitals are challenged to be able to meet that 12-month deadline, and so we're proposing to extend it to 18 months. This will allow us to have more accurate data to make sure that hospitals are able to review their information and correct any mistakes so that our payment systems really are based on the most accurate information available. And then the second, again, technical change is to amend our statutes regarding hospital outpatient payment methodology. The statutes say that we have to follow the Medicare data used for setting hospital rates. Medicare has adopted the Ambulatory Payment Classification System, or APC system. Medicaid has been using that system as well, conforming with what we believe is the spirit of our law and maintaining adherence and alignment with Medicare system. But we'd like to get our statute language clarified so that, that it's clear that we're using the APC system within that. So with those last little technical changes, I am now very pleased and honored, Madam Chair, to turn the presentation over to our Assistant Commissioner for Community Services, Gertrude Mutemba Mutasa.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Anderson. And Gertrude Mutemba Mutasa, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Gertrude Mutemba Mutasa, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports at DHS. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'll just dive right in. So homelessness is an ongoing crisis that impacts communities across our state. And we know that the pandemic has not made things any better. In fact, it has worsened the crisis regarding homelessness. This proposal would increase base funding for the state's emergency services program by $10 million for the biennium, which is $5 million per year. And that funding would be used to provide more shelter space in our state. The proposal would also establish base funding for the Homeless Management Information System, commonly known as HMIS, at $1 million for the biennium and $500,000 per year. HMIS is really important as we're tackling this issue of homelessness because it is used to collect client-level data on the provision of housing services to individuals experiencing homelessness, as well as those who are at risk for homelessness. This proposal would also increase funding for the Community Living Infrastructure Grant Program, which is really, really important because this funding is used for counties and tribes to integrate housing services into the rest of their human services work. And this proposal would provide $20 million for the biennium and $5 million per year towards that. All right. On to school-linked mental health grant. This $6 million investment is essential for several reasons. The first reason is that the pandemic has exacerbated mental health needs for many, including children. And so more than ever, families are in need of clinical supports to effectively cope with mental health needs that have been increased due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We also know that for some children, particularly BIPOC children, the school is the only place where they can get consistent mental health services, and the schooling mental health program affords those children that opportunity. And we also know that school-linked mental health services can really be a tool to help to keep kids out of the emergency departments of our hospitals, which right now we cannot afford to have them going into the EDs. Minnesota school-linked mental health program helps schools and families to identify and to treat mental illness by providing assessments, counseling, and tools for teachers and staff so that they're equipped to help and support students. The funds distributed to school-linked mental health providers may be used for a variety of uses. They may be used to mitigate service interruptions and to prioritize in-person services. They may be used to purchase critical care supplies or to cover public health-related training costs. And they can also be used to address the specific mental health needs of communities of color and American Indian communities related to the COVID-19 public health emergency. And this is really, really critical as we're continuing to really be laser focused on equity across our state. The other really important thing about this proposal is that it also supports the well-being of educational staff during this pandemic. So $1 million of this proposal is designated for safe spaces for teachers and other school staff. Okay. The next three items related to behavioral health and disability grant proposals. The first item is right-sizing of behavioral health grants. It's worth noting that in approaching this exercise to right-size grants within the Behavioral Health Division, we looked at several factors. And across the board, the grant programs that made it on this list were ones that had significant historic underspending. So I'm going to quickly step through some of the impacted grants. It's also important to mention before I dive in that all of the items listed under the behavioral health grants are one-time reductions. So I'll start out with the Adult Mental Health Integrated Fund grants, where this proposal would reduce the funding by 6.6% for fiscal year 2022-23 and 2.9% for 24-25. The Recovery's Peer Specialist Grant would see a reduction of 50% in fiscal year 22-23 only. There's also a reduction in Mental Health First Aid Training Grants, and then a one-time transfer of $1 million from state gambling proceeds to the general fund related to state gambling proceeds. And then the next item is related to realigning disability grants. The same logic applied, which is we looked at significant underspending over the years. There are a couple of items here where we are completely eliminating the grant program, and I will specify which ones those items are. In total, this realignment is going to result in $8.9 million. In fiscal year 22-23, and the same in the 24-25 biennium. And the aggregate reduction would be 17.8% across the grants in the disability services world. So the first grant, I'll step through these quickly again, that we'll see a reduction will be the Family Support Grant. This proposal will reduce that grant by $600,000 each year, And that's approximately 14% of the current grant level. And the next grant that will see a reduction is the semi-independent living grant, which will see a reduction of 8.4% in fiscal year 22. The next item is the State Quality Council, which would be completely eliminated because funding for the council is no longer fully utilized due to staff vacancies and other factors. So this proposal essentially eliminates the full appropriation of $600,000 per year starting in fiscal year 2022. The next item is day training and habilitation grants. And these are grants typically issued to counties for day training and habilitation services, really designed to offset a portion of a county's costs of day services. They are typically accessed by persons who are not enrolled in Medicaid-funded home and community-based waiver programs. And this proposal would eliminate the grants to counties for day training and habilitation starting in fiscal year 22 by $811,000 per year. And that's 100% of the current appropriation. The last item on this list on the disability grants that are being eliminated or reduced is the Disability Services Innovation Grant. This grant will see a 52% reduction, and this reduction will be administered by reducing large grants intended for organizations, but maintaining access to micro grants for people with disabilities, as well as some of the smaller grants. So that's that part about the grants. The next item relates to aligning the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, the timeline with grants. So a little bit of background about this council. It's commonly known as ORAC, or the Opioid Council. It was established by the 2019 legislature with a mandate to develop and implement a comprehensive statewide effort to address the opioid epidemic in Minnesota. The council includes legislators, providers, advocates, county and tribal representatives, as well as state agency staff. The governor is proposing that effective July 1, 2021, that ORIC grants awarded for child protection be issued on a calendar basis. And what this will do is it will align the timeline for issuing the grants with the fee collection schedule. And this will allow the council to know how much money has been collected before issuing an RFP. This past year in 2020, I sit on that council. The council issued an RFP in anticipation of having adequate fees in the account. And it turned out that because of the pandemic and other litigation, there was not enough money in that account. So this would help to address that. And now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Kulani Mote.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please.
Members of the committee, my name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS. And I appreciate the opportunity to go over some of our proposals in our licensing and background studies areas. So the first proposal going to address today is in regards to adding a set of providers to our background study requirements. And this is going to be for our early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention, or otherwise known as EIDBI providers. EIDBI autism services are provided as a medical assistance benefit in its treatment to people under the age of 21 with autism spectrum disorders and related conditions. And so what this would do is what this proposal would be is to add that those EIDBI providers would be operating within our DHS background studies requirements, and this gives improved protections for children and youth who receive these important services. The next one I'm actually going to address is going to be bullet point number 2, where we would be proposing to establish an annual license fee for our withdrawal management program. So the withdrawal management program licensing requirements were enacted in 2015 to provide a higher level of medical services to assist clients with more acute withdrawal symptoms and to allow Minnesota to add withdrawal management services to the medical assistance benefit set. When these licensing requirements were enacted, an annual licensing fee wasn't established. At the time, in 2015, the intention was the withdrawal management program license was to replace the detoxification program license. And when that would occur, an annual license fee would be established. However, with the differences between the two programs, some of the differences being the intensity, the admissions eligibility requirements, and funding sources, the department has now allows for programs to be licensed as a detox program or with withdrawal management program or both. So this proposal would establish, according to the license capacity and based on current fees that are required in a detox program license, an annual fee for withdrawal management program. Now, there are some programs that would be dually licensed, and in those instances, only the fee for the detoxification program wouldn't be assessed. So we would only ever be assessing one fee for all those dually licensed programs. The next proposal I'd like to discuss, I need to go back one more slide, please, thank you, is going to be the second bullet point and regarding creating a fee schedule to address DHS's need to be able to recover the actual costs for background studies. So the Background Studies Division is responsible for performing statutorily required background study checks for people who provide services to children and vulnerable adults in licensed and in unlicensed settings. And this is a fee-for-service enterprise, and the background study fees that are assessed are set out in statute and have remained mostly unchanged since 2005. And the division current funding model relies on these fees to support all of their operations and administrations and to cover all of the expenses and costs associated with doing these checks. Over the years, the costs associated with background checks have been on the rise and have significantly outgrown the revenue provided by the current fixed fee schedule. This proposal would remove the background study fees from statute and implement a fee schedule that would allow DHS to recover actual background studies costs. This would ensure that DHS would be able to meet increased demands for studies, to respond effectively to the increasing complexity of our studies, to avoid and remedy any study backlogs, and to also, as I noted, address the escalating costs of conducting these background studies, which are often paid to third parties, in order for us to obtain and receive criminal history and registry searches. The added benefit for our providers and employees with this would also allow us to standardize our studies, so it would increase the possibilities of studies to be transferred between employers. Next slide. The other proposals that I would like to address are some additional federal compliance proposals. The first is a proposal to bring us into compliance in order for us to receive in order for us to meet federal regulations. The first change will ensure that DHS can continue to receive the necessary data from the FBI in order for us to conduct appropriate background study searches and checks. The second change ensures that DHS would remain in compliance with the child care and developmental block grant and to receive the necessary information in order for us to not sustain a penalty under those requirements. The last compliance issue or proposal I want to discuss is in regards to conducting background studies for two other entities. So in 2019,
Ms. Moti, excuse me a second. I'm going to just, I don't know how much you have left, but we need to wrap up your part so that we get some time for MBH.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I will do that really quick. So DHS is required to conduct background studies for two entities, the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, otherwise known as PELBSB, and for MNSURE. That initial legislation for PELBSB was enacted in 2019, but during the implementation, it was brought to our attention that we didn't have the necessary language in statute in order for us to be able to conduct this, and this proposal would bring us into compliance in order for us to receive the necessary data from the FBI to conduct both of those so those studies for PELBSB as well as for MNSURE. And with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Harpstead.
All right, thank you. Commissioner, okay, you're going into the Blue Ribbon Commission strategies. We have run over time and the Department of Health hasn't had an opportunity. Can you, I don't know if you can shorten this or, you know, I leave it to you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Briefly, some of the Blue Ribbon Commission strategies that we wanted to point out to you as the purchasing strategies to reduce cost. Over the years, the data is clear that that we get better prices for pharmaceuticals in our fee-for-service Medicaid program than in our managed care Medicaid program. And if we did all the purchasing across the state in our Medicare Medicaid programs, we would cut significant MCO and pharmacy benefit manager administrative costs and bring savings to the state of Minnesota. We have similar ideas for non-emergency medical transportation, durable medical equipment, and dental. Next slide. Most of our hospitals today use the Encounter Alert system so that people can be alerted that people have been either admitted or discharged from a hospital. This would build out that system to include additional primary care, behavioral health, and disability providers, for example, to use the system. And I'm going to skip the next slide. And just mentioned briefly that we wanted to put a placeholder here in the budget. The governor asked us to put a placeholder in the budget in case the U.S. Supreme Court rules the ACA unconstitutional and we need to react to it somehow during the session. So stay tuned in case that happens. Early analysis suggests it may not be necessary, but we wanted to point that out. And we've been asked, as all government agencies for the state, to add an operating adjustment to the DHS overall budget. And that is our presentation, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Commissioner, and to all of your team for this. And I'm sorry to rush you at the end there. And I know some of the stuff you rushed over was very important to us. But just to remind the members that this will not be the last time that we'll hear about these items. And we'll also get a lot more detail as time goes along here on both on the money part of it, but also explanations of what these various items are. So with that, I would like to call on Margaret Kelly from the Department of Health to talk about the Department of Health budget proposal. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to be here today to talk with you about the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Health. We were in front of your committee, I don't know when, it feels like a month ago, but it was probably just last week. Commissioner gave you an overview of who we are and what we do. And this presentation is specific now to the proposals that the governor is recommending in his budget for the Department of Health. I have with me today our CFO, Joshua Bunker, who is going to walk you through the slides, and a few folks within the department who can answer any detailed questions you may have on the proposal, and we're happy to take questions offline as well. And then before I turn it over to Joshua, I just want to extend a welcome or appreciation from Commissioner Malcolm, who would have liked to have been here today, but was not able to join us for this hearing. But she wishes she could talk about the great additions the governor is making to our budget and why we've proposed the cuts we are. But I will turn it over to Joshua Bunker. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bunker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for having us today. We have a slide deck that is probably in the neighborhood of 21 slides. I will only present from 10 of those slides today. We have a number of slides at the end of our presentation that are at-a-glance information for you and the members on our various happenings.
Great. And just a reminder, Mr. Bunker, I believe these have been mailed out to members, and they are available on our website for the public. So thank you, for observing that we're kind of running out of time here, and we do have a bill to hear as well. And I do hate to rush you because this is very, very important to us, but thank you for understanding.
Madam Chair, thank you for your time very much. I will move swiftly through our slides. The first slide is a version of what you and the committee have seen already. It is a presentation of the impact of COVID upon our agency operations. Want to, in this process of discussing the base budget, point out not only that the blue bars represent our base, they've only increased by a little over 1% each year over the decade, but the green represents the spending and effort so far toward the pandemic. You will notice an almost doubling of our resources for the present biennium, and as of now, only $40 million leaking into fiscal year 22. We anticipate that that amount may indeed increase a little as vaccination and testing activities continue into the future. Next slide, please. This slide demonstrates the number of FTE in the agency as of the end of last fiscal year. You will see on the right side of the slide the variety of classifications of different types of positions that operate within the agency. A little over 1,500 FTE for the last fiscal year. There was certainly an increase in our federal expenses at the end of last year due to coronavirus relief fund spending. You would see that represented in spending in the top bar with federal monies. These amounts of 1532 FTE represent an additional almost 400,000 additional regular and overtime hours put in by staff and redeployments from across the enterprise on COVID activities. And that is close then to an equivalent of 177 FTE that were added to the effort beginning in late March and moving through the end of June. Next slide, please. This slide represents a cross-section of our known federal awards at this time moving into the next biennium. All of these grants would be represented on our federal fund summary at the end of our department's reports for the governor's budget. We would like to point out that while a number of these grants for us would be base awards, a fair percent of them actually are ones that are competitive for us, where we are competing against other states to win these monies and be able to continue to do our activities within the state. You will see, of course, the main federal agency of HHS, but monies that come out of the sub-agencies as well. Department of Agriculture is the nutrition program, and then other small programs along the way. Next slide, please. This is the first glimpse into our uses for the next biennium. We're proposing through the governor's recommendation right around a $1.3 billion budget. Half of that comes in the form of outgoing grants and aid. You will see a list on the right side of the page of where the larger grant programs, how they're aligned and where they go out from the agency. Coming around clockwise, you'll see employee compensation of 28%. This maintains our workforce and supports all the grant staff that manage the grants that are on the right side of the chart. And then the operating expenses that are showing 23% of our proposed budget. That includes our space leases, our supplies, and IT costs. Now, those IT costs actually for a minute at MDH represent about 20% of that item right there, coming in just under $60 million. Next slide, please. Spending by program, and program defined as budget program or bureau, the $1.3 million distributed across our three bureaus. Health improvement, you see, is the largest slice, and within health improvement, just wanted to note that community health is the location of the present $42 million of continuing COVID federal funds right now. Health protection amounts to 23% of our budget, and health operations, which is made up of HR, communications, human resources, legal services, et cetera, That is the location of many of our administrative costs. That is funded by $35 million in general fund monies, plus $70 million over the biennium of indirect costs. So those are expenses that are incurred around the other bureaus, and then those monies are transferred over to health operations to spend in a way that is more efficient, especially for facilities and supplies and things like this. Next slide, please. You'll see a breakdown of costs by those divisions within the bureaus here. So everyone is accounted for on this slide. It's noted that, again, our large grant programs are really the reason for the large size in our top three divisions. Child and family health includes right around 60% of those expenditures for the WIC program. Health policy has 65% for Merck grants there, and community health has another 63% of outgoing grant programs. It also includes the $42 million for the COVID funds. So that, again, is just sharing with you kind of our relative size. Of note, the infectious disease and public health labs are usually our areas of smallest activity. However, they are quite busy right now during the pandemic. Next slide, please. Moving on to our governor's recommendations. This is a summary slide that is showing the recommendations that occur across three funds: general, state government special, and clean water. I will talk about the investments and reductions by fund in the next slides. Next slide, please. We'll go on to the general fund. The general fund, we have three investments and four recommended reductions. Our operating adjustment can be found on page 16 of the governor's budget, and you'll see after each of the recommendations the corresponding page number for the governor's budget book for reference. Our operating adjustment was calculated by MMB from compensation costs for both MDH staff and Minute at MDH. Those amounts represent about a third of the costs for Minute at MDH. They will support the cost of position increases and employer insurance contributions for both agencies. The fetal and infant mortality review fund on page 17 is to reestablish the authority of the agency to access records related to infant deaths and fetal deaths so that MDH will be able to reconvene the state's fetal and infant mortality reviews to uncover those factors that contribute to infant and fetal death. That data will help us to provide the department with the ability to make policy and system changes, improving conditions, especially addressing significant disparities within populations most affected. The maternal morbidity and mortality review, found on page 19 of the budget book, will expand the state's mortality review committee to review a sample of maternal morbidity cases in addition to all maternal mortality cases. This will provide comprehensive information to better identify and target the root causes of maternal mortality and morbidity, especially in disproportionately impacted communities of color. On to the reductions. The Right Sizing Home Visiting Grants, found on page 41. The Nurse Family Partnership Program is one of seven evidence-based models currently supported through other state and federal grants. And due to the increase in medical reimbursement for nurse home visits beginning in January of 2018, there's been an underspending of grant funds. So given this pattern of underspending in implementing agencies, we believe that there will be minimal impact to services provided to children and families. And this proposed reduction of $500,000 per year represents a 20% reduction to this program's present funding level of $2 million annually. The right sizing of the fetal alcohol syndrome grants at $117,000 a year is a proposed 6% reduction to that program. Since fiscal 2010, underspending of grant funds in this area has ranged from 10 to 25% of total awards. And so given the historic underspending in services and the subcontracts for fetal alcohol syndrome disorder support and education, we believe the impacts to our state will be minimal. The next reduction is the eHealth Advisory Initiative reduction, which proposes elimination of the staff position, funding for the staff position that's associated with this effort. The state, I should say health, will manage the reduction due to no longer having to address expired federal requirements that were set in 2009. In addition, we will reduce workloads, meetings, and other deliverables in this section. So manage within. These investments and reductions come out to a net reduction for the biennium of $210,000 from the general fund. I apologize, I skipped right over the last item. The Merck Formula Grants reduction, apologies. We're proposing to eliminate the general fund portion of the just under $60 million annual Merck Formula Program. This $1 million reduction would represent 1.7% of the grants funding. This reduction would not impact the International Medical Graduate Program that is on the Healthcare Access Fund, but would reduce just the Merck Formula Grants by that 1.7%. Next slide, please. We're moving on to the State Government Special Revenue Fund.
Okay, and Mr. Bunker, if I could, we're kind of running over time here, and I do see that we have a couple of questions. How much do you have left? I don't think we need to, as I said before, this isn't our only opportunity. How much do you have left?
This and one more slide, thank you.
Okay, I don't think we need you to read through the slide. If you could just hit the highlight and then go to the next one, and I'd like to give these two members a chance to ask their question.
Happily, thank you. The largest needs within the state government special revenue fund is to address a projected $10 million shortfall by the end of fiscal year 2025. The proposals for fee increases would address right-sizing the fees against the anticipated expenditures to address requirements within all of these programs. And then there are a number of technical changes that are noted at the bottom of the page, which include a cancellation of $2.5 million from roll forward monies from 20 to 21, and then a $2.5 million reduction in the home care area as that program transitions to assisted living providers, and so therefore a smaller ongoing home care program itself. Those reductions should not impact program delivery in that area. And then I would just note on the next slide, last slide, that the Clean Water Fund investments are ones that are appropriated through a different committee in the House, the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. These are monies that have to be requested according to state law every biennium. Just noting that protecting drinking water is part of creating conditions that ensure that communities can remain healthy. And so these activities certainly align with the mission of the department as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mr. Bunker, and sorry to rush you through your presentation. I have Representative Pryor. Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't ask my question now, but if somebody could follow up with me after the meeting today, then there's just a section of it that I'd like to understand better. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Pryor. And that does raise the question. Maybe I could, I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but Normally we do get budget books. I don't think we've seen those yet unless it's at my office and I haven't been to my office. So how are we getting that this year with all of the detail? Are these going to be supplied online? Maybe a link rather than just giving us all a book with all of the change pages? Who can address that? Does anybody know?
Madam Chair, Margaret Kelly here. I know that there is probably a link online somewhere that we can forward to you. I don't know if you are actually going to be getting printed documents themselves. I think your staff could check in with them and be on that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Sorry to throw it out in this setting, but to represent a prior's question, we will be provided with a lot more information in detail, but, you know, thank you for, you know, reach out to these folks as well. I'm sure that would be a good idea as well.
Yes, Chair. Proposals has a description, a several-page description in the book.
Right. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, to the last discussion, MMB is not printing budget books this year because of the COVID environment. I did send an email to all members and staff of all three committees that handle HHS accounts yesterday, I guess. Oh, yeah, it's yesterday. The budget came out with attached PDFs of the base budget books and governor's recs for all the agencies under the jurisdiction of each committee. Those are very large files, but all the detail is in there.
All right. That's excellent. Thank you, Mr. Berg, for filling us in on that. Okay, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all of the presenters. Mr. Bunker, I just have a quick question. I'm thrilled to see more maternal morbidity studies included. And I'm wondering if you can define what maternal morbidity will be studied, if you have a definition of what that is. And then secondly, it's my understanding that the fetal alcohol grants have been fully spent, so I just wanted to register concern that they're being cut.
Okay, thank you, Representative Morrison. And, you know, again, I just want to kind of alert members, and that's, you know, it's great to flag that. Thank you very much. I just want to say to members that those especially who haven't been through this process before, this is the governor's kind of opening proposal. The governor proposes, the legislature will wrestle with all of these things just simply because something's proposed doesn't mean it's going to happen. And it kind of lays us out a roadmap for some things to work on and chew on. And of course, there are going to be member proposals that aren't in the budget as well that could end up in our final budget proposal as we put it forward from the House. So just want to flag that. But thank you. So the fact that we don't have time today for a lot of discussion of the items that we've seen here, I would venture to guess that there are probably things that might cause heartburn for some members and other things that we might want to say, yes, I love that proposal. But we'll have plenty of time, I think, to hash these things out and talk about them further. So thank you, Representative Morrison. And thank you very much, all of our presenters. And Mr. McQuillan has reminded me that, in fact, that Mr. Berg did send out that email, and that also with the documents for today's hearing, there were attachments more with some of these items. You can tell I haven't really looked at mine yet, but there's a lot more detail in the email that was sent out with attachments for today's meetings. So, all right. Well, thank you so much to all of our presenters. And obviously these documents represent a ton of hard work on the part of these agencies. And this is really challenging time and really challenging work, and coming up with a budget, even just the initial proposal, is very challenging. So thank you all for your very good work. So if we could take down the screen sharing here. Thank you. Okay, great. So with that, we are going to move on, and we're a little bit behind schedule. We're going to have to move quickly, but we're going to hear House File 269. So Representative Morrison, who's a member of this committee, is going to move that House File 269 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And with that, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 269 is a bill to allow Minnesota to join the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, or PSI-PACT, which is an interstate compact that facilitates the practice of psychology and telecommunication technologies and or temporary in-person face-to-face psychological practice. The benefits of PSI-PACT include increasing access to care by providing services to populations that are currently underserved or geographically isolated, facilitating continuity of care when a patient relocates or travels. It certifies that psychologists submit acceptable standards of practice, and it promotes cooperation among PSI-PACT states in the areas of regulation and licensure. It offers a higher degree of consumer protection across state lines. It decreases logistical burden on psychologists and allows licensed psychologists to practice telepsychology and or conduct temporary in-person face-to-face practice across state lines without having to become licensed in additional PSI-PACT states. So far, 15 states have joined PSI-PACT, and I believe 12 others have pending legislation. The bill has bipartisan support, and I particularly want to thank Senator Benson for carrying the bill in the Senate, where it passed out of the HHS Finance and Policy Committee earlier this week. I do have two testifiers, Dr. Tricia Stark, who is a practicing psychologist and the chair of the Minnesota Psychological Association Legislative Committee, and Sam Sands, who's the executive director of the Board of Psychology.
Okay, thank you, Representative Morrison. So just, I do apologize to our testifiers. We are quite restricted on time. We only really have 14 minutes left in this hearing. So if you could be very, very brief. I have Mr. Sands first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sam Sands. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology, and I'm testifying in support of House File 269. I'll keep my comments brief. The board supports House File 269 because it supports the board's mission to protect the public through licensure, regulation, and education to promote access to safe, competent, and ethical psychological services. It protects the public by allowing competent psychologists to practice telepsychology into the state, psychologists who are already currently licensed in other states. It increases access to care. It also allows for a continuity of care as business people come into the state on business trips. They can continue to see their regular psychologists as they would in their distant state. The other thing that I would say is that this legislation provides mechanisms for the board to expel or discipline psychologists practicing in Minnesota without a license. Currently, we only have the injunction authority, but we would, with PSI-PACT, be allowed to revoke the authority of a psychologist practicing into the state. Also, that commission could then revoke that licensee's authority to practice in any state. Also enhances our ability to work with other states on disciplinary issues. And then as a final note, we're not asking for an additional appropriation to implement PSI-PACT. The board is willing to absorb the costs associated with this legislation. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Sands. Thank you for mentioning about the fiscal note. Members should have received that, and it does show a small cost that the board would be absorbing. So I understand that since that would be the case, this bill will not go to Ways and Means. There's a small data piece that takes it to Judiciary, but other than that, I think it would go straight to the floor in case there would be a question. Ms. Stark, do you want to say a few words? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about PSI-PACT. It is the national standard for providing safe psychological services across state lines.
And I'm sorry, but could you just introduce yourself for the record too? Tell us who you represent.
I am Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist and chair of the Minnesota Psychological Association Legislative Committee. Let's see. There are three important parts to PSI-PACT. The first is continuity of care. It increases access to psychology services in underserved parts of our state by providers in other SIPAC states, and it provides for protection of the public good. Anyone who is practicing as part of SIPAC must be aware of local resources should an emergency arise and must be culturally competent to care for the specific population they're serving. And these standards are really important to the protection of Minnesotans. And I just ask that you support SIPAC because it enables continuity of care and access to care with good public oversight.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Stark. So questions from members. I don't see any right now, so I will start by just asking. I've been told that there is no opposition to this, and I certainly haven't heard any. Representative Morrison, are you aware of any?
Madam Chair and members, I am not aware of any opposition to this bill.
Okay. And members, if you looked at the language of the bill, I just wanted to flag for you that when we do an interstate compact, essentially every state is adopting the same bill. So the way the bill is written may look a little bit foreign to you because in Minnesota, we don't usually write bills with whereas clauses and things like that. But when we do a compact, generally speaking, we're not allowed to amend it because it has to be adopted the same in all states. Am I correct in that, Representative Morrison? That's your understanding?
I understand, yeah.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak briefly in support of the bill, and specifically this continuity of care piece and how valuable that is for patients to have that consistency and get the care that they need when they need it, where they need it. And so I am just really grateful to Dr. Morrison for bringing this bill forward, and I stand in firm support of it, and I hope that members will see fit to support it as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bonner. Other questions? Representative Pryor. Oh, we can't
hear
you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your question, asking was there anyone in opposition, and I have not heard anyone in opposition. In fact, I've heard constituents in strong support of this legislation. So thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing it forward. And thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to hear it today so that we can move it forward and get it through the system. And thank you, testifiers, for being here.
Right. Thank you, Representative Pryor. And let me just ask another thing. I had understood that there was some urgency about this. And I don't know if we're going to meet the deadline that I had understood there was, but Ms. Stark, maybe Dr. Stark, I'm sorry, maybe that you're the person to address this piece of it and why we're kind of taking it up early and trying to move it through quickly.
Yes, Madam Chair. There is funding through the Federal CARES Act for the licensing fee of $400. That expires January 31st, which is why we're rushing. I've instructed our psychologists to apply now, and if they get their applications started before January 31st, they will be able to get the coverage for the licensing fees. But that's the press.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, I hope our legislative process is not really lending itself to all of that, to speed. We're not an institution built for speed, but I hope that that'll work. And, we certainly hope that that'll be of assistance that they'll be able to get that advantage by our moving it through now. Anything else from members? Okay, not seeing any questions or other comments. So, we have 7 minutes. How can this be? All right. After I made the testifiers go really fast, is there anything that either of the testifiers wants to say to conclude, since we do have just a couple more minutes here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But no, I think I will allow you to get out a little early if that's possible.
Okay, thank you. Representative Morrison, any final words from you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Madam Chair and members, I urge your support so that we can continue to expand mental health access. Thank you.
All right. So with that, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House Bill 269 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. So the clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Minority Leader Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Daymuth.
Aye.
Representative Daymuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grünhagen.
Aye.
Grünhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Representative Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. That's 19 ayes and zero nays.
All right, thank you. So there being 19 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed on to Judiciary Committee. So congratulations, Representative Morrison. And with that, members, our next meeting is 1 o'clock on Monday. We don't have the agenda yet, but we'll get that out to you soon. And there being no further business today, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.